Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Belated Happy New Year. My name is Jerry, and I am an alcoholic. Can you hear me on that thing? Okay. First of all, I'd like to thank Adam and the Breakfast Club for the honor and the privilege of addressing you this morning. And I will say this, it's been a long time, but you guys really know how to put on a good feed. As a retired 70-plus-year-old who lives alone, I'll tell you, I'll go almost anywhere to eat anything other than my own cooking. So it's a great pleasure to be here this morning. Mark Twain once observed that it's a terrible death to be talked to death. So after a meal we just enjoyed, I realized staying awake could be a challenge. And for some of us, it's awfully early in the day. So if I hear a hearty snore, I will not be offended. I will just take that as an indication I have talked too much. Well, as I said, my name is Jerry. I am an alcoholic. I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous right here at the Howe Place in May of 1998. So if you're listening and you know your math, you've already deduced that I am not a one-chip wonder. And basically that's what I'm going to talk about this morning, because that is my story. Not so much how I got here, but how I got back here. There's not many people around who remember me from the first go-around, the early days. It wasn't pretty. I was the typical hopeless case, broken, broke, jittery, unemployed, about a hair's breadth from suicide. I had been told by the person that I lived with that I could drink myself to death if I wanted to. It was okay by him. He just didn't want to watch it. So I could get help or get out. So I came to AA. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps, sort of. You see, I have an undeserved reputation of being fairly intelligent. And that is not true. As Sheldon Cooper says, my mother had me tested. But I was blessed with a significant amount of formal education. Reading books, retaining what I had read, and parroting it back on request was something that I'm pretty damn good at. And I was good at it in AA. You know what? Things started to get better. I got a job. Then I got a better job. And I retained those jobs and actually got paid. I began to clear up some of the wreckage of my past. I went through a bankruptcy to get my financial affairs in order. I bought a car at one of those buy here, pay here places. And I don't recommend that. If you think interest rates are bad in the regular world, go to one of those places. It's terrifying. But now I could go to work and come to meetings without having to sponge money or a ride off somebody else. I even started swimming to lose a few pounds, get a little bit better physical shape. And at home, I was a hero. Nobody in this world supported my recovery like Bill Collier. He watched me with pride. Every chip I picked up, every anniversary was a milestone he celebrated. And I was getting to where I was on top of the world. So what could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? I'm an alcoholic. I could go wrong real fast. Back in those days, there was a little saying that used to be bandied around the place called, fake it till you make it. I haven't heard it in a long while, so I don't know if it's still in vogue or not. And that's exactly what I was doing, friends. I was faking it. I wasn't drinking, but I was not happy. I missed it. Somehow, that first go-round, I never was able to smash the delusion that someday, somehow, I would be able to control and enjoy my drinking. With that mindset, it was only a matter of time. And I was faking it, you see, because I had this vague notion that I didn't belong here. You see, I'd heard your stories. I heard what people told me. And I wasn't like most of you. I'd never had a DUI. I'd never been arrested. I'd never seen the inside of a jail cell. I'd never been hospitalized or sent to a rehab center. That's no virtue. I was too broke. I couldn't afford it. So just exactly what was a nice guy like me doing in a place like this? So I was angry about having to be here. I resented the implication that I was some sort of criminal on the dodge, you know? And I was terrified that you would find out what a colossal phony I really was. I faked it for 5.5 years. I had a job. I was making pretty good money. I was working the evening shift from 3 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. And with no real conscious forethought or planning, one evening right after work, I pulled into a liquor store and on the way home and bought a bottle of Seagram's 100 Piper's Scotch. I felt alive again. You know, our book tells us, doesn't it, that we are unable at times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month, or in my case, 5.5 years. The bottom line was, why does anybody relapse? I'll tell you why. Because you want the drink more than you want anything else. That's it. But I knew I could make this work. The two big lies had taken hold of me. Big lie number one, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Sound familiar? Hold that thought. Big lie number two, nobody will ever know. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. And yes, I was that damn stupid. Here's how it worked. I would not drink while driving. Oh, no. That would be terrible. Instead, I would drive to a very secluded place and park my car and drink while I was sitting still. I would only have a sip or two straight from the bottle. That's all. No more than 1 or 2 ounces maybe. And the bottle would stay in the car. Because I knew I couldn't have it in the house. You know. You see, because of the shift I was working, I rarely got home before midnight. So Bill was usually in bed asleep when I walked in. So a supply of breath mints, a little bottle of mouthwash next to the bottle of scotch, I was good to go. And of course, when I went in the house, I'd always brush my teeth before going to bed. Now, That was back in the days when I had teeth. See, these are as phony as a $3 bill, as phony as I was back in those days. So there was no smelling it on my breath. That was the plan. Nobody will ever know. Good plan, wasn't it? And after all, I wasn't hurting anybody except myself. Now I want you to know I was rather proud of my clever self. A bottle would last me well over 2 weeks, a sip or two a night, right? Okay, drinking straight from the bottle that I sat in the car trunk during a Georgia July day could be kind of nasty. But I could stop at QT I passed every night, get a little cup of ice. Then I would drive to this little secluded spot. It was the office park, right across Allgood Road from the house I live in. I could drive in there. I could pour off the water that had melted, pour in a little whiskey, and just have a sip or two. Much better. And I would think, I'm not hurting anybody except myself, and nobody would ever know. And I would despise myself, even as I congratulated myself on being so clever. I was still going to meetings. I was still talking the talk. I was still wearing my happy face for all the world to see. Look at me. I am a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated myself, and I hated what I was doing. I'd tell myself that when this bottle ran out, that was it. It was done. It went on for 3 weeks, maybe a month. Now, I had done a fourth and fifth step, of course, but it wasn't a complete fourth and fifth step. I'd withheld some things. Now, I'm sure that I am the very first person in the entire history of Alcoholics Anonymous to fudge his fourth and fifth step. But it was eating at me. It was eroding everything I touched. It has truly been said that we're only as sick as the secrets we keep. I can testify to the truth of that statement. Our lives, our secrets, they have a way of turning on us. I noticed that I was irritable. I was irritable with my coworkers. I was irritable with Bill. I was irritable with the world. But I told Bill, I told my sponsor, I'm just having kind of a rough patch right now. I'll be all right. I'm fine. Nobody will ever know. I'm not hurting anybody except myself. Well, that ounce or two, guess what? That was steadily increasing. Now, I was never really drunk, I don't think. But I was in that frame of mind that knew no pain and was happily irresponsible. I was making telephone calls when I got home. Now, that was not unusual because anybody who's worked the evening shift from 3 to midnight thereabout, your opportunities to talk to people were somewhat limited. Because when you get home, the world's gone to bed, and when you get up, the rest of the world's gone to work. So I had a list of people that would be up at that hour that I could talk to during that time of the night when I got off work. Here's the funny part. Some of them were in AA. Now, calling someone who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous while you've got a buzz on is not the brightest idea you'll ever have. And like I say, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and yes, I was that stupid. My attitude and my behavior was making Bill uneasy. But that was all. I was functioning. And we were getting along because I had done so well in AA. He really didn't want to ask me anything. But apparently one night I had made a phone call to somebody who knew both of us. She was also in AA. Next day she called Bill. Bill, is Jerry drinking again? Bill told her, I don't think so. Are you sure? She asked. And Bill said he was pretty sure, but he couldn't say for certain. Poor Bill was in a quandary. He really didn't want to confront me, but now the seed of suspicion had been planted. Big lie number two. Nobody will ever know. He was certain there was no liquor in the house. That was true. One morning, while I was still sleeping, he went out and he looked in my car. Keeping it in the trunk had proved to be inconvenient, so I had just moved it to the glove box and kind of padded it a little bit so it wouldn't rattle around. There it was. Bottle of scotch in the glove compartment really isn't a good hiding place. Now I come to think about it, he left it there. I got up, and he said nothing to me. He gave no indication that he knew or anything, none. I left and I went to work. When I got home, Bill said, I have a message for you. Your sponsor called, wants you to call. Okay. So I called my sponsor with a cheerful, what's up? I was asked one question. Are you drinking again? And don't you dare lie to me. And I said, yes. Is there a bottle of scotch in your glove compartment? Yes. So what are you going to do now? I don't know. Do you want to stop drinking? Yes. No, I mean, do you really want to stop drinking? Yes. Then here's what we're going to do. I was given a few instructions and we hung up. Big lie number two had been exposed. Nobody will ever know. Oh, hell, everybody knew. I got up and I went to talk to Bill. Said, we needed to talk. It was Friday night. It's after midnight. Neither one of us had to get up and go to work the next day. And I fessed up, told him everything, and I saw the pain in his eyes. The inexpressible sorrow and hurt. I couldn't have hurt him more if I'd taken a knife and stabbed him in the heart. Big lie number one had come home to roost. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. No, I was hurting the one person whose only mistake had been trusting me. The enormity of that betrayal hit me in the gut. We talked, with me being totally honest with him for the first time in 5.5 years. There was no anger. There was no recrimination. There was no outburst. He asked me only one question. What are you going to do now? start over, I told him. Do it again. Do it right this time. He nodded. And that was all. I swear to God, Bill Collier was the most natural-born Al-Anon I have ever met. Now, he's never been to an Al-Anon meeting. He'd never read any of their literature. He didn't have to. He could separate me from my behavior, and he could be mad as hell at the latter while still loving the former. That's the thing about Al-Anon. It will just completely ruin a perfectly good enabler. Bill was not an alcoholic himself, but he had read our book. He understood the nature of this cunning and baffling disease. He understood me a lot better than I understood myself at that time. All he said to me in that conversation, I believe in you. I believe in you. The delusion was smashed at that point. So I started over. Per instructions from my sponsor, I went to my home group meeting, the early Sunday morning group, and when the chair asked if anyone had something they needed to talk about, wanted to talk about, something like that, I raised my hand. And I told my home group what I had done. They said, welcome back. I picked up a second white chip that Sunday. That was September 9th, 2004. My sponsor set me to work. We agreed that I needed to start over from scratch. I was told, as intelligent as I am, that I knew nothing. I was told that instead of looking at the differences of other AAs, I should look for the similarities. I was told that I'd have to convince my sponsor that I was ready to move from one step to the next and not before. I was told that other than asking a question in a meeting, I had nothing to share. I needed to take the cotton out of my mouth and put it in my ears and listen to people who had succeeded in staying sober, who wanted to stay sober, because I had proven that I was not one of those people just yet. Some of our medallions have the inscription, know thyself. Well, sometimes you can't know yourself until you know who you don't want to be. Becoming the man I wanted to be, that was what I wanted for myself. Around this point, my sponsor suggested I read a book that's outside of AA literature, The Four Agreements by Miguel Ruiz. I recommend this book highly. Now, I admit I don't buy into all the Toltec wisdom that Ruiz writes about, but The Four Agreements were on spot, or spot on for me at that time and place. If you don't know what they are, here are The Four Agreements. These are agreements that you make with yourself. Number one, be impeccable with your word. Number two, don't take anything personally. Number three, do not make assumptions. Number four, always do your best. The Big Book, the 12 and 12, and the Four Agreements showed me the kind of man that I wanted to be. Be impeccable with your word. That one's pretty simple. Yes means yes, no means no. Yes means yes, not maybe, not if I feel like it, not, well, unless something better comes along. No means no. There's nothing wrong with saying no. No can be a complete sentence. Don't take anything personally. I like to take things personally. I like to take everything personally, whether it was meant personally or not. Trish Kay sums it up very nicely when she says, people aren't doing to you, they're just doing. But I have a tendency to give people space in my head when those people may not know and certainly don't even care if I exist or not. Do not make assumptions. I'm sure you've all heard what assuming does to you and me. Don't assume, as the lawyers like to say, facts not in evidence. A good friend gave me a baseball cap that says, don't believe everything you think. And if your thinker is as unreliable as mine, that's good advice. And always do your best. That's where I went wrong, you see. And my first attempt at sobriety, I took half measures only. I learned that if I wanted sobriety, it was all or nothing. Like a good poker player, I had to go all in or fold and drop out. In the case of alcoholism, Stephen King puts it best, writing in The Shawshank Redemption, there's only two options. You either get busy living or get busy dying. So I got busy living. We went through every step, slowly, meticulously. And this time I learned more than just the words. This time I was taking it to heart. It reminded me that I'd never been to jail, never had a DUI, never been to hospital, all like that. I learned that that was a gracious and generous God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I felt progress was slow, but I was frequently reminded just how little I really knew about anything. We plodded along till steps 4 and 5 came along. And I assumed, what did I just say about assuming? But I assumed I'd do it with my sponsor. I'd redone my 4th step this time. I'd included everything. Some of the ghosts that got stirred up, I didn't like. But it was hard, but I did it. That's when the curveball got thrown. My sponsor had heard my previous 5th step, so this time I was to find someone else to do the 5th step with, and I would find a complete stranger. Someone who didn't know me from Adam's house cat. What is the 5th step? We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, and I needed to find somebody that wasn't hostile to me, but wasn't very friendly with me either. An indifferent third party, if you will. It took some looking, but I found someone who agreed to meet with me right back there in that room here at the Howell Place. I have heard people say that after they did their 5th step, they came out feeling liberated, uplifted, freed. That was not my experience. I was terrified of confessing all my troubled past, all my misdeeds, All my 5.5 years of faking it, all that was in my dark and shriveled up little soul. I pulled into the How Place parking lot, wondering how bad it would get if I just turned around and pulled out again. Knowing my sponsor, pretty bad. So, I took a deep breath, went inside, and as Nike likes to say, I just did it. It took over 2 hours, but I did it. The gentleman who had agreed to listen to this sat impassively, just listening. When I was finished, I was a wreck. I was trembling with anxiety and shame and humiliation. When I was done, he asked quietly, "Is that all?" "Yeah." "Did you leave anything out?" "I don't think so." Then he asked me if I would join him in a prayer. He reached across the table and grasped both my hands, and he said, "Dear Lord, you've heard this man's admission for you and to me face to face. Thank you, God, for letting me meet this good man." This good man. Dude, whose fifth step did you just listen to? But as instructed, I called my sponsor when I got home to report the deed was done. I was asked, "How do you feel?" I was devastated. I felt like there wasn't a rock big enough for me to crawl under. Now I was told, "Then you probably did it right." Of course, as I started working the next 6 steps, that feeling passed, and I did feel unburdened. I did feel liberated. I had no idea how heavy that load was until I'd laid it down. Those were the first glimpses of the man I wanted to be. Well, I got through the subsequent steps. After my vigorous and thorough fifth step, you could say, I got busy living. I got busy anyway. I discovered that service work was and is essential to sobriety. I was honored to be the GSR for the early Sunday morning group for a number of years. I've served in several posts, several things, but the main thing I was busy at was working my program to become the sort of man I really wanted to be and knew I hadn't been. I picked up in the course of time, I picked up a few sponsees, sponsored a few guys. Some of them made it, some of them didn't. You all know how that goes. All I can say is I learned a whole lot more from them than they ever learned from me. Although Bill had retired, I worked my program hard until 2018. Bill was developing some cognitive declines, so I retired to care for him. In July of that year, he fell and broke his femur. He had to have surgery to repair it, and that was partially successful, but it aggravated his mental and cognitive state. But we were managing. I had to cut back on my meetings because he couldn't be left alone. So unless somebody could come and sit with him for a couple hours or so, and people did. He had a few cognitive issues, but he was still lucid. And he knew exactly what was happening to him. Through his surgery, through his recuperation, through his rehab, his constant refrain was, "I've got to get better. You're working too hard taking care of me." He had to get better so I would not have to work so hard to take care of him. But because of my program, because of my recovery, I could be there for the person who had always been there for me. The person who told me, I believe in you. The week of Christmas, 2019, he caught a cold. Saturday evening after Christmas, he became unresponsive, sitting at the dining room table. I called 911. The ambulance took him to Kennestone. He developed pneumonia in both lungs. He was given antibiotics and oxygen. He was responding well. He was transferred to a rehab center to get his health back, get his strength back after 2 weeks being bedridden. He was doing pretty well, but he was so weak and so frail. He'd tell me to go home and get some rest. I'd tell him home was where he was, as long as we were together. 2 weeks later, the pneumonia came back. He slipped into a coma. And on January 28th, 2020, I lost him. I was with him. We had been together 44 years. My world pretty much ended that day, I thought. I don't remember much of 2020, to tell you the truth. Bill died. The pandemic hit. We went into lockdown. I was grieving. I was isolated. And for the first time in my adult life, alone. I was absolutely and utterly on my own. And my friend's loneliness took on a whole new meaning. I didn't do a lot that year, but cry a lot and pray a lot. But I found out just how much the generous and loving God of my understanding was doing for me that I could not do for myself. My AA family stuck by me. When Bill was in the hospital, you'd call, see how he was doing, see how I was doing. You'd stop by and visit. Tell me, go get some hot food. Or maybe go home, get a couple hours rest. After Bill passed, you were kind enough to let me grieve in my own way. Shared pain is still pain, but it doesn't hurt quite as much when you spread it out. And eventually, I started to come out the other side. I'm still not fully there, but as Crippled Porgy sings at the end of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, "Oh Lord, I'm on my way." It's a long, long journey, but you'll be there to hold my hand. A few months later, I was going through his desk. In a drawer, bottom drawer tucked away, was a little box. I opened it, and I started to cry. In that box, carefully arranged, in order, were two white chips, two aluminum chips. They're gray now. Two red chips, two yellow chips, two green chips, and 23 blue chips from both times. When I'd celebrate an anniversary, I'd pick up a chip. And my sponsor at that time said, when you're celebrating an anniversary, go to several meetings and pick up a chip so that others can see someone succeeding. And I did. And I'd always take one home to the man who believed in me. and believed in me to stick it out long enough to obtain real sobriety. And he'd save them all, every one of them, the complete history of our journey to my recovery. Now I am old, and I can honestly say, and I often do, that I am not yet the man I want to be. I am not yet the man I am going to be. But thank God Almighty, I am not the man I used to be. I work the 12th step daily, trying to practice the principles of AA daily in all my affairs. I try to be impeccable with my word. I try not to take anything personally. I don't make assumptions. And I always try to do my best. But I have one last desperate desire: to live long enough to pick up my next blue chip. If I make it to September, I will celebrate 20 years of genuine sobriety. The last couple of years have been the toughest I have ever experienced. But by the grace of a loving God of my understanding, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I was once told, I believe in you, I'm standing before you this morning. And I can say to you, I believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in you. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Twas grace that seen me safe thus far, and grace will see me home. Thank you for your kind attention.